Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stack Waddy Game, I've got a great one. This is...
Far away.
This is British exploitation, pop exploitation films of the 60s.
Okay? Oh, good.
You know the kind of thing?
Yeah.
They put together a swinging soundtrack in order to sell some idea to the, to the kids. You know. So, okay, five of them here. One of them is made up. Okay.
Yep.
It's Trad, Dad.
Oh, very good. Yeah, go on.
The Miniskirt Murders.
Very good. Yeah, like it.
The Pleasure Girls.
Yeah.
Gonks Go Beat.
These are brilliant. Yeah.
And Cucumber Castle. It's Trad Dad, The Miniskirt Murders, The Pleasure Girls, Gonks Go Beat, and Cucumber Castle.
Well, it's Trad Dad. It's Trad Dad was a real film. I'm sure I can remember that.
It was. It was. I'll let you know that.
Pleasure Girls, yeah, Gonks Go Beat, I'm suggesting is real too, because gonks were a big thing, as was beat music. Some clever person put them together, and it wasn't you. And... Cucumber Castle, I don't think is exciting enough to be the one you made up. I'm saying it's either Pleasure Girls or it's do you know what? It's the Miniskirt Murders.
You bastard.
Yeah.
You're right. It's so
That's
difficult.
Brilliant. Yeah. Were they British films? They were. They?
It's Trad Dad was a kind of a EMI financed exploitation film with kind of Kenny.
Oh, Moore yeah.
All those people in it. And the Pleasure Girls is a real film about. Girls going crazy in swinging London. Gonks Go Beat.
That's a fantastic.
I think it features the Graham Bond organisation.
That's brilliant.
I do believe it does. And Cucumber Castle was a film made starring the Bee Gees.
Oh,
there's
really?
Actually a Bee Gees record called Cucumber Castle during the sort of late 60s period. So there you go. You win that one.
That's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, we didn't really have an equivalent to the beach movies of America, did we? Do you remember all those movies with Annette Funicello? Not that I ever saw any of them.
Beach Blanket.
And they were always called sort of poolside pushover.
No, it's beach, and it was, beach usually had the word. Beach Blanket Bingo was the classic.
Beach Blanket Bingo, that's right. And it was always Annette Funicello in a bikini.
And, Tab Hunter and Russ Tamblyn usually involved.
That's
and the
exactly
soundtrack
it.
By Dick Dale
That's
and
it.
The safaris and so forth. So what have you got for me then?
I've got for you, okay, pop stars advertising products
did
the last
really?
50 years.
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right. Five of these items were endorsed by these acts and one of them wasn't. Okay. And it is your mission to try and spot the ringer, okay?
That's a good idea.
Cream. Go. Okay, Cream. Once did an ad for an American beer called Falstaff. Okay, that's the first
one. Okay, yeah.
Jefferson Airplane wrote a single, a jingle rather, for Levi Jeans.
Right.
All right. Cilla Black's Anyone Who Had a Heart was used to promote Wall's heart-shaped strawberry ripple ice cream. Okay.
Ooh, that's good.
Dusty Springfield did a TV ad for Mother's Bride Bread. Okay. Okay, then leaping a few decades into the present, actually, Marilyn Manson once advertised a type of 66.6% alcohol proof Mansanth. It was a kind of absinthe called Mansanth. And Snoop Dogg promoted.
You always have six. Go on.
I always have six, I do. And Snoop Dogg promoted Burger King's grilled dogs. So you've got Snoop Dogg, Marilyn Manson, Dusty Springfield, Cilla Black, Jefferson Airplane.
Oh.
And Cream.
You had Dusty Springfield, didn't you? Mother's Pride.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick that one.
That one's real.
God,
amazingly.
Wow.
I know, If you go to, if you Google it, you can find it. It's extraordinary. And she appears in it too. As is, and also is real, Cream did the ad for Falstaff, which is brilliant. A clear beer from St. Louis brings you Cream from London. Falstaff, the thirst slaker. This is Jack Bruce singing. Falstaff, the thirst slaker, the beer that can slake any thirst. This is 1966. Jefferson Airplane, I think, right now with your white Levi's in 1968. Marilyn Manson's real. Snoop Dogg's real. No, the one I made up actually was Cilla Black. Cilla Black did have that thing, but also there was an ice cream at the time called Heart. I remember thinking as a kid, I was thinking that would be a brilliant song to advertise.
Should have been a tie-in.
But the one that I was going to put in, but I couldn't work out if it was real or not. Have you heard about it? It's one called Wake Up in the Morning, Rice Krispies by the Rolling Stones.
Yes, there is. Oh, it's real.
Is that real?
It is real. They did but quite early on, 63 probably, they did a kind of a raging R&B version of the Rice Krispies theme. I don't think they appear in it, but
it sounds like Jagger, certainly. Again, that's on YouTube. Wake up in the morning, there's a snap around the place. Yes. Wake up in the morning, there's a crackle in your face. Yes. It's absolutely amazing. I found all sorts of other ones. Iron Butterfly did a roll-on deodorant ad.
Who did, most strangely? They did an ad for joining the United States Air Force. And this is in the middle of the war in Vietnam, so it's slightly more controversial than ordinarily. You know?
Well, I managed to get to this point in my life not even knowing that.
So David Bowie. David Bowie.
Oh, he did sake, didn't he? Japanese sake? Oh, he did all sorts of things.
He did an ice cream called Love, L-U-V.
Oh, yeah, he did. That was in the 60s,
wasn't it? Yeah, 65, 66.
That's right. Like that. Yeah. That's right. So, and Ringo starred in Pizza Hut, of course, quite recently.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Oh, well,
in this case, Dreamboat, Diana Rigg.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Be Still My Beating Heart.
Absolutely. So, yeah, what was
God,
she?
I adored her.
Well, I adore, all red-blooded men adored her, and all kinds of blood, other kind of colours of blood. But what I remember she was first female that my father and I both agreed that we fancied.
That's true with my dad.
I don't think there was any discussion about it. But you know,
but you could tell.
You could tell that he.
Should we watch the Avengers? Slightly keen. Yeah. I know. But the other big ones for me: Julie Christie, Jane Fonda, Françoise Hardy. Françoise Hardy. There was a brilliant episode with Dylan, which I'm sure you can remember. You remember that? Dylan was playing at the Olympia in Paris in 1966. Yeah. He did his acoustic set, and he could see Françoise Hardy in the second row wearing an amazing kind of houndstooth trouser suit. And he told the promoter that he wouldn't go on and play the second half, which was the electric set, unless Françoise Hardy had been brought backstage to meet him. Pretty amazing, wasn't it? They had to go and get her.
Absolutely. That's pulling power.
It is pulling power.
So we were talking about Diana Rigg, and you informed me that Emma Peel was the interesting derivation of the.
I had no idea.
I didn't. Go on.
Apparently, it was an expression in the 60s, which is male appeal, was known as M appeal. So in the script, they wanted a girl who had, to play that part, who had M appeal, had male appeal, man appeal, rather. And they eventually finished up calling her M appeal. I mean, that's what I just never knew.
I know.
I were having this conversation because I said I also only discovered about Sandy Shaw that was a pun quite recently. And then you tweeted it.
I did.
You see, and this is a huge reaction.
Fantastic. This is extraordinary, you know, because I probably knew more recently than you, but it still took me a long time. During the, you know, the Sandy Shaw's period of her huge hits in the 60s, I was not aware at all that Sandy Shaw was some kind of smart pun supposed to mean a sandy, you know, seashore.
Crossed my mind.
And that possibly this also tied in with the idea that she sang in bare feet, you know.
Yeah.
Feeling the sand between her toes, kind of thing, and so I just tweeted this. You know, it was years before I realised that Sandy Shaw was a pun, and it was amazing the response. The loads of people going, "My God, I've only just realised that when you said it, and I'm 62," kind of thing. You know? And then you get a load of people going, "No, I'm sorry, I still don't get it.
It's got to be explained to me."
And it's really hard to explain the thing to you. And then you get a load of people from Scotland saying, "Well, no, it doesn't work up here because we say Sandy Shaw in a different way, and I don't entirely understand.
I didn't understand that.
I didn't understand that.
Maybe he's a real southerner.
And then there were people saying, oh, in the north, it doesn't make sense. Well, I come from the north, and, you know, it sort of makes sense to me, you know. But it's really odd how you can kind of, you know, these puns, if you don't get them straight away, you just kind of look past them, don't you?
You don't
hear them at all. And, of course, the classic case, I got loads of response to this with loads of things that pointed out that, you know, for instance, adamant, which was, I think, partially pinched from
Adamant, wasn't it?
There was a TV sort of Saturday evening
hero,
kind of rock Doctor Who type thing called Adamant. And people pointing out that, which I never knew, that Perry Farrell,
I didn't know that.
And Jane's Addiction is peripheral.
I mean, what a weird thing to want to allude to anyway. It just makes me not terribly excited. But isn't that with Perry Farrell?
I never thought of that. And of course, the one that somebody told me years ago, which I didn't know at the time, but I got to know a few years later, is Faye Fife from the
Red Faye Fife, no, that's right. I didn't know that till quite recently.
Which is
Faye Fife, which in Scotland you talk about being from something. He's a Faye, aren't you? You're Faye Glasgow, aren't you?
Yeah.
And she's from Fife. That's absolutely amazing.
That's a really good one, that is. It's a really good one.
It's a brilliant one. Pete Briquette, I think I got because I knew what a Pete Briquette was.
And apparently,
I mean, a lot of people must have thought that's just a strange name, because a Pete Briquette was a briquette made of peat that you burned on your fire.
It also is something that you apparently quite commonly saw by the roadside in rural Ireland. You'd go past a garage.
Yeah, that's right.
They'd be selling Pete Briquettes, you know.
That's right.
They'd be there, you know. So, yeah, I don't think I was aware of that at the time. And there was something, somebody pointed out one yesterday, and I've got their albums here. I bought these records.
Go on.
And I saw them live in 1971, actually. Flo and Eddie. Flo and Eddie, who are, you know, Mark, who are they? Howard Kalin.
Remember the Turtles?
Howard Kalin and Mark Volman, formerly the lead singers of the Turtles, went out on their own and then sang with Frank Zappa and then made records on their own.
Is that a pun, Flo and Eddie?
No, it's also, think about it, Flo and Eddie. It's what happens, it's wind flows.
Oh, right.
You know, and Eddie.
As in water. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I suppose so.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. A river would flow in Eddie.
Their terms related to the movement of water. And I've just told you that now.
I had no idea.
This is classic.
Oh.
This is classic. None. Of course.
That's pretty esoteric, isn't it? You didn't know the one about Johnny Marr. But actually, I don't even know if that's true now. There was various people on your thread were saying it wasn't true. But Johnny Marr, we always thought around the time of the arrival of the Smiths, was based on the fact that it meant I'm bored in French.
In French.
Jean Aymar. I'm bored.
But apparently not. It was just a different way of spelling it, because his name is John Mayer, isn't it?
Which is the same
as the drummer from the Buzzcocks one of the members of the Buzzcocks. And I only realized, when I used to have a radio program on GLR, for 10 years, there's certain records I used to play a lot. And one of my favorites was, oddly enough, I haven't played it for years, my bar group formed by, what's his name, Gary Clark, who was formerly Danny Wilson, you know.
Okay.
And I used to play this record all the time and say, that's so-and-so by so-and-so. I always like it. And the name of the group was King L. Okay?
For years,
completely innocently, I love that King L record. Never occurred to me for a second
that it is brilliant.
It was a kind of, you know, a rude expression in any way. Of course, the other ones I'm just reading up here, obviously, Buster Blood Vessel, that's kind of straightforward.
Polystyrene,
XTC, you know, Ecstasy, Lip Sync, you know, Lip
Sync. I didn't know Lip Sync. I didn't know that. Did you?
Lip Sync? No, that's
news to me.
You kind of say it. And then, you know, somebody suggested members of Gong. Was it Didier Malherbe?
Well, that's just a sort of Didier is a French name, and Malheur means wasn't his name Captain Mal de Grasse?
Mal de Grasse, bad grass, all that kind of thing. But of course, the classic one, apart from the rapper called Flo Rida, which of course means Florida, classic one that people were still saying that they only kind of saw it quite recently. And this boggles the mind, really, but it illustrates a point about this. The Beatles.
Yeah, I know.
The Beatles.
Because you didn't, if you thought of it as a pun at the time, if you thought of it as a pun at the time, you forgot it very quickly. It just became the name of the group. And you didn't sit there and think, that's an agonizingly awful. We've had this conversation on podcast Pass In there. Is the Beatles the worst name for a group?
Well, probably.
It is.
But it is. Because it is still remarkable, isn't it?
That it is.
Absolute entertainment phenomenon. And probably this evening somewhere in Britain, there's some 18-year-old going, "Oh God, the Beatles! Oh, I get it.
Beat music.
I know. talk about hiding in plain sight. That's absolutely astonishing."
Somebody else put on, I think it was Nigel Tassel, our old pal, was talking about Electric Light Orchestra. It took him ages to get that gag that it could either be an orchestra called Electric Light, or it could be electric light orchestra, exactly. Yeah, so it's worth both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's so funny because you just absorb these things at a certain age, and if you don't spot them at the time, you don't spot them at all.
You never spot. Okay, another one I never knew. Chubby Checker.
Oh,
was
God,
a play on Fats Domino.
Yeah.
That never crossed my mind.
I didn't know that
yesterday.
I didn't know that at the time, but I probably knew it a few years.
It's incredible. And nor did I know that Sugar Babes was a play on Spice Girls.
I didn't. Still didn't know that.
No. Isn't that amazing? Sugar Babes. Cool.
So anyway, look. If you've if you've got any more, you may have more. You know, I feel that there's a whole seam of these that haven't been uncovered yet.
There's unfinished business there.
So you know, let us know, wiye.london@gmail.com, and we'd be happy to bring them to people's attention in future podcasts.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Okay, welcome back. We've been joined by Magic Alex Gold, who is... Where, Alex? Where are you? Go on, tell the people where you are.
I'm at the Hilton Garden Inn, Heathrow Terminal 2, the Queen's Terminal.
The glamour.
Oh, the glamour. I've got a coffee machine. I've got some milk. I don't drink milk, but it's just nice to have it there. Great selection of
good.
See, having just played Magic, you just played a gig at somebody's wedding. You did all the music for the wedding, live performance at a wedding in Berlin, right?
Chiefly Impossible, and played a show during a pandemic. Yeah, it was astonishing. So I went to Germany to a place called Buckau, which is kind of halfway between Berlin and the Polish border. Box Germany, really picturesque, beautiful kind of olden town. I played them in during the ceremony, which is lovely al fresco affair next to a lake. And then I played some bangers at the
what bangers? Go on, what are the bangers du jour for weddings?
Take Me Home, Country Roads, Never Lets Me Down, Brown Eyed Girl, bit of Beatles.
Brown Eyed Girl always been good to me. Yeah. Which Beatles?
I did help because it was easy for them to sing. You've got to pick ones that, you know, they're amenable to German people singing along to.
So listen, it's your considerable experience at playing in rock and roll bands.
Yes.
In front of all kinds of audiences that we particularly want to tap into. Harness, absolutely, at this stage of the podcast, because this started when I they have reissued the Rolling Stones' Goat's Head Soup with a kind of additional music, additional CDs, and one of the additional things is a bootleg of the Rolling Stones, which was recorded at a show in Brussels, I think in 1973-74. It's been around the bootleg for years, and it's pretty good. But listening to it struck me forcibly once more, why do the Rolling Stones in particular and groups in general seem to play their greatest hits so fast and it to the extent that it's unsatisfactory? And so I tweeted to this effect, you know, I would like musicians out there to tell me, you know, why do bands play their greatest hits too fast? And I got loads of responses. I got loads of sarky responses from people, non-musicians or whatever. You know, they want to get them over with, all that kind of stuff. And I got the occasional considered thing from a musician, including Henry Priestman, who said, I've no idea. And Henry's been playing in bands for a long, long time.
40 years or so, yeah, right, yeah.
And he doesn't really know. And what loads of people said, oh, it's adrenaline, or it's all that. What do you think, Alec? Is it the case that people, have you found that either going to see shows or taking part in shows, that people tend to play their big hits faster than they ordinarily would?
I think a lot of it is adrenaline, and it sort of distorts time. And I'm really bad for this myself, actually. I'm what they call a pusher. I'm always ahead of the beat, and it's just a bit bad habit I've got into. But you think you're playing slower than you are. The adrenaline distorts your view of tempo and time, and somehow you think you're playing at the right speed, whereas in fact you are playing too fast. And if you listen back to yourself, you realise that actually that sounds really fast, but in the moment you haven't got a clue because it feels right, you know.
I'm going to interject, because big hits are always played at the end. They never played at the beginning. Surely the adrenaline must have worn off after an hour and a half of being on stage, isn't it? Haven't you calmed down a bit? I can imagine the first few numbers being a bit nervy and a bit pacey, but I don't know.
No, I don't think it does. I think that there's a tendency to also mistake speed for power. You know, and
speed for excitement.
Yeah,
for excitement, because there's the idea that if you play faster, it's got to have more impact. It's got to be more thrilling. It's a bit like lights. The more dazzling the lights are, the more exciting it is. The more you're bombarding people with sensory impression.
But it's mainly the drummer, and the drummer will set the pace. And the drummer will have the least clue generally with regards to how fast or slow they're playing. But there's a really good rule of thumb. Which works especially well in the studio, and that's to try and approach your tempo with a mindset of walking through a swimming pool. So feeling the resistance. If it feels a little bit slower than it should be,
you're right.
Playing at the right point.
Now, you see, I think this is really interesting. And, you know, as I've said innumerable times on these podcasts, I'm no musician, but I know what I like. And the Rolling Stones recordings that they do live too quickly have in their original incarnations precisely that resistance you talk about.
Yeah.
There is a sense of it's just being held back.
Back.
No matter what it is. You know, just go and listen to Jumping Jack Flash. It's not racing away. It's just, it's like somebody holding on to horses that if you let them go, they would take you too fast. The classic case is Satisfaction, which they recorded in 1965, and I don't think they played it right since the day they recorded it.
Yeah,
because
they always play too fast.
Play too fast, but you know. So I think you have the adjustment that in their head they think it's faster, and then as nerves play a part and adrenaline plays a part, it gets even faster. You know what I mean? So you get the quick thing. That's done too fast.
Well, it's surprising with the Stones, because Charlie's a jazzer for a start, so he should know better. And also, he's famously behind the beat, you know. So it's kind of surprising that they're running away with it.
Well, I want to ask you two questions about drummers, because you are a drummer yourself.
Yeah.
Now, if you're saying that the drummer sets it up at the outset, if you're the drummer playing a live show, you're very much aware, presumably, that it's to do with physical stamina, isn't it? So you would naturally not play it too fast, wouldn't you? Because you think, I've got to be able to keep up with myself.
No, it's not physically exhausting in the same way that going, you know, for a session at the gym is, or going for a run. It's not knackering like that. That's the thing, and it's quite invigorating. You don't feel tired. You really don't. And in fact, the more you put into it, the more you feel inclined to put into it. It's a really strange thing. But yeah.
How much do people play to click tracks? On Dave's thread, lots of people talking about click tracks. I mean, I'm astonished if that's the case.
A lot more these days. It's pretty much standard fare these days. And it's something like...
So explain to lay people like me, what's a click track? Go on, and how does it work in a live context?
So a click track is a metronome, essentially. And it's a series of metered clicks set to a particular tempo, and you play along with it. And the idea...
So the drummer's got that in his ear?
The drummer's got that in his ear. And of course, with the advent of a lot more music using samples and loops and things like that, it's increasingly necessary for the work the music's put together. It's a metronome, basically. But I read something really interesting. It was an article on how the approach to tempo in popular music has changed over the years. And they were measuring, I think, a modern EDM track against stuff like Message in a Bottle by The Police. So Stuart Copeland, another jazz musician, you know, meant to be really, really good. He is really, really he's great, obviously. Yeah. But the tempo, apparently, it goes all over the place. That thing speeds up and slows down, pushes and pulls all the time.
But isn't that attractive? I like that.
Okay, but it's interesting. If you, which Police records are you talking about? Sorry, what was the one you mentioned?
Message in a Bottle.
Yeah,
Message in a Bottle. Not a dance record, I would guess. A very good record, very big number one hit record, not a dance record. Nobody goes, oh, that's on, I'm going to take to the floor. Therefore, tempo wandering all over the place, less of a problem, I would have thought.
I don't think it's necessarily a problem anyway, because it gives music its human element, I think. Yeah. And as long as everybody's all going in the same direction, you listen to a record like My Generation, and I still think that's one of the most exciting recordings ever to be committed to tape. It's just perfect. And that's all, it's all over the place. It's all over. It's so, so messy, but somehow it's perfect. And it's what draws you in is its imperfection, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there's arguments for and against, you know.
But presumably, you see, Mark and I were talking about, you know, there are certain acts, not many, that we could think of who don't seem to fall victim to this. I don't think Bruce Springsteen does. You know,
We don't think McCartney does either.
And I don't think McCartney does. If Bruce Springsteen plays Born in the USA, they're playing at the tempo.
Because you can see with somebody like Bob Dylan, who's constantly speeding up. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Bob Dylan is either bored of playing these songs or slightly embarrassed about playing them, or slightly resentful about the fact that people are much more interested in hearing this terrible version of Maggie's Farm than they are hearing some song that he wrote, you know, 12 months ago, and he feels quite strongly about.
But also... Yeah. Bob Dylan's quite a scrappy musician. I mean, obviously, yeah, he's the greatest writers of all time, but in terms of his musicianship, he's not a virtuoso by any stretch.
No.
Whereas someone like McCartney is, you know, McCartney's a musician's musician. So
well, Dave has a very good theory about this. And Dave's theory is, which I'll do for you, Dave, McCartney's band learned all McCartney's songs, not from McCartney, but obviously from growing up listening to his records. So yeah, they're fans. They grew up with the Beatles.
They want to hear it. They want to hear Magical Mystery Tour or whatever it is, the way it sounded when the record came out.
So they're seeing it. Very rare thing, actually, for a group. They're seeing it from the audience's
perspective.
They're hearing it because, I mean, a lot of the time, the difference is that the bands see the material they're playing in such a completely different way from the people in the audience and can't register what it is that it might mean to them.
I'm going to tell you, isn't that true? A little bit interesting about the Beatles band that I play for. So,
yes, I should point out, because if anybody knows about being in the Beatles, it's Alex, because you've been in Beatles, you know, tribute bands, cover bands, whatever. Yeah. You've done hundreds, if not thousands, of these kind of shows. Therefore, you're playing incredibly familiar material. Go on.
So, for the middle period and later period stuff, we use additional samples and loops and click tracks. And one in particular sticks out, it's Magical Mystery Tour. Now, what the guy who put together the samples has done is he's beat matched our sample with the actual recording, and the actual recording of Magical Mystery Tour pushes and pulls in really odd places. It's really so the click is actually at about four different tempos, and the poor Ringo, whenever we play it, he's got to somehow follow this.
It's got to change tempo.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So it kind of, you know, completely belies the point of having the click. But he wanted it to be as authentic and as and to mirror the original recordings as much as possible. You know, a sensible person would have just done it to the click and done it to one tempo, and nobody in the audience would have cared. You know, would have noticed. But he's done it. He's done it precisely to the tempos on the record, and. Poor Andy. Every night he's having a bit of a.
So what's interesting is, you know, when I put this tweet out, I don't think anybody denied it, did they? Everybody just agreed. No. Oh yeah,
they all said it's true.
Whether it's strictly true or not, the audience certainly feel that these things are being hurried. The bit that they've come to the show for is being somehow glossed over by the musicians who would rather play you their new tune.
Precisely. It's perfunctory, isn't it? Yes. There was a bit of, somebody tweeted a thing saying that Frank Skinner said he was at a Chuck Berry gig, and Chuck Berry told the audience, if we do a little of each one, we'll get more done. So he was doing kind of medleys, which sounds absolutely appalling. Having said that, of course, Queen's medley at the Live Aid was one of the behind.
Well, it worked
on that occasion because people understood you've only got 20 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got to get it all in. But I mean, the idea that someone would just do a medley of their greatest hits.
Well, that used to be the Motown way. You know, that was always the complaint about if you went to see the Four Tops or whatever in the 60s. That they'd rush through, they'd start playing "Reach Out, I'll Be There," and then it would morph into "Standing in the Shadows of Love," and the audience are not sitting there going, "Oh, whoopee, a medley." They're going, "Bloody hell, stop, go more slowly,
go back and play the whole thing."
And I get some musicians in response to my tweet saying, "Well, who's to say what's the right version?" Which is all right, a fair point, you know. But I would counter that by saying there are hardly any examples I can think of where people have gone on stage and played their hits more slowly. They haven't mucked about with it in that way, have they? They mucked about with it by accelerating it, because that's just the way they are.
Yeah, but I would say that there's probably a bit of a lack of awareness that they don't realise that they're doing it. You know, they're kind of carried away on the energy of the room, of the stadium, whatever, and it's distorted. They say time's stretchy, don't they? Time is not linear, and it's. But this is a whole different conversation. But
now, do you know what live pop music needs, Alex? Because I'm here to tell you, and it never has. Well, listen, in the theatre, they have things called directors. Okay, and you know the actors taking the stage at the beginning of Hamlet. They've got just as much adrenaline coursing through them as any musicians, but they don't whiz through the ghost scene in like 2 minutes and, you know.
Because they're nervous.
They just don't do it because they know if they did it, a director would bollock them afterwards. You know, there would be regular reviews of the performance. You know, Sorry?
A friend of mine was playing violin for ELO last year, I think it was, and I was quite surprised to learn that ELO have an MD. Jeff Lynne apparently has an MD who sorts out all the band's arrangements, and it's a really good idea. You end up with a real solid prospect, you know.
So as a music director, somebody there to kind of, to ensure discipline.
I think that happens more than you think, actually. The bass player of Bob Dylan's band is the musical director. He just does all the arrangements, and Bob Dylan just has to come in and growl the vocal, you know.
Yeah.
It's all taken care of.
Yeah.
But it's a question of keeping, you know, if bands are not aware that they're playing slightly faster than they ought to, it surely isn't beyond the wit of man to correct that problem by somebody saying, you're playing slightly too fast. Rein it in a little bit.
Like the theatre, like getting notes at the theatre.
Yeah.
Well, so the director will turn up halfway through with a little notebook saying, "I'm in a bass player. I think you'll find than on, you know, drummer, message in a bottle, a little bit too speedy again.
Okay, but in every, all right, so, but in every other area of music, that's exactly what happens, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The conductor or the leader of the orchestra or the, you know, whoever leads the jazz group. Now, Alex, you've also had experience, not just rock bands, but with ukulele orchestras, haven't you? Which are very kind of different thing, aren't they? And that hasn't got a a conventional drummer there, has it? So presumably doesn't have these issues.
The tricky thing with the uke orchestra is because there's no drummer, and you've got, so how do I explain this? So studio musicians will, in the main, have a tendency to be on tempo. Musicians that mainly play live and don't do an awful lot of studio sessions, they're the ones that push, that tend to push. And in the uke orchestra, you've got a spectrum of 7-8 players, and you've got some draggers and you've got some pushers, and so you do end up sometimes with
you need the two. I think that's a really good way of looking at it. Is it draggers or pushers?
Draggers v pushers.
All bands should have a couple of draggers against a couple of pushers, and somehow you'll end up in the right place.
But you've got no drums, so and normally you're listening to the drums for your tempo. You know, you're going along with the bass drum and the snare drum, whether you realize it or not. So with that missing, you have to be a little bit more aware. But our musical directors, our musical director, which should be a thing for rock bands as well, is pretty tough on all that. You know, he does pull you up every day. He pulls me up every day on my tempo. But I did a tour with a orchestra a couple of winters ago, and that was an experience.
Playing what instrument?
So I was playing guitar and oud, which is like a Turkish sort of 11 string. It was horrible, but I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad I've got that under my belt now. But so we had a conductress. So I had my music on the stave in front of me, and I was reading that, but also trying to watch her.
So you can sight read, can you, Alex?
I'm not great. But I had to teach myself pretty sharpish when I joined the uke orchestra. So in the uke orchestra, we don't have a conductor. So our MD, he'll sort us out in sound check, basically. And right. Then, you know, it's kind of set up like a band, I suppose. But
I told you about my experience when I was doing a thing with a jazz orchestra.
Okay.
And just going along to a really good jazz orchestra. I wasn't playing an instrument. I was narrating or whatever. And I went along to we're having a sound check, right? It starts at 5 o'clock. It'll be finished by 5:30. I thought, give over. I thought, in my experience, sound checks expand to fill the time available for them, don't they? They just absolutely go on forever. And I got there.
Not if there's 27 people or whatever.
No, but they'll finish at 5:10 because basically what they do is they say, okay, bar 32.
Yeah.
And so they just run bar 32. He goes, okay, that's better. Bar 74. And then the next tune and the next tune, and that's, we sorted out the problems. Because you're not playing the whole thing, are you? It's not feel. It's just taken for granted you can do that. It's just cleaning up little problems, isn't it?
Yeah, spit and polishing, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's a really good approach, because, you know, if you're doing a long tour, you know, and you're constantly tidying up a little bit of the show every day, you know, you can really feel the progress by the end of it. You know, you do.
So what's the fastest song you've ever played, Alex, in your experience? And your mad punk moments, have you raced through some Clash tune in like 10 seconds or anything?
It was probably a punk rock tune, actually. So I used to play with a band called The Boys, who were Joey Ramone's favourite band. I fell into a lot of 70s punk rock work for some reason for a few years. And we used to play a song called Box Number, which is a reasonably fast number anyway, but we used to play it at about 10 times the speed. It was like several freight trains running off several cliffs at the same time. But
to the great enjoyment of the band. But, you know... Probably some puzzlement among the audience.
Yeah, not so much the audience, maybe.
Well, look, thanks very much for that.
That was riveting.
Injection of consultancy. We shall return to you.
A rare professional tone. Yeah. Very good.
We're slipping up. We're giving people bits of information amongst everything else. And so we'll be back in a moment.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So we were talking on the pod a couple of weeks back about various acts being righteously pissed off that Trump had appropriated some of their songs and used them in his campaigns, and they were complaining about it, trying to get it stopped legally. And it's just an interesting development, wasn't it, the other day, that Trump played this rally, appeared this rally, and used the song Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Which, I mean, whenever that came out, was it? They were late 60s.
Well, during the Vietnam War.
And it was used as a kind of example of how people managed to avoid
the draft.
They had rich parents, and it was all that sort of, you know, excuses for getting you out of actually having to take part in it.
Yeah, the refrain is, it ain't me, I ain't no fortunate son.
That's right.
And of course, Donald Trump was the absolute classic.
Classic. He avoided draft, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So
it's Bone just, Spurs day. Yeah. Isn't it the Bone Spurs? It was.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And the irony there is richer than usual, isn't it? Yeah. But I suppose it just indicates that, you know, people don't listen to what these songs are about.
They don't. You'd think that he would have a team. Well, he does have a team of fairly astute researchers to make sure that kind of faux pas doesn't happen. But it does. People constantly play Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen and those kind of things, don't they? Working out precisely what the song's about.
It's roughly what, you know, they appear to kind of exemplify embody attitudes that he wishes to be allied with, you know, kind of I don't care me, I say what I like, you know. And it's quite interesting about the kind of, the kind of outlaw heritage of rock and roll ends up being used in this particular way, you know, which says lots of things about how the world has changed in the years since those things were originally done. But that's a very complicated conversation.
It is.
Which we can't get into here. But anyway, tune in for more news on extraordinary things played by Donald Trump at rallies in weeks to come. You know, who knows what it'll be? The times they are changing. I don't know. No idea. So what are we going to do? We've got to talk about all the things that we do. Actually, we've got to remind
people. We've got some new patrons. We should mention the new patrons. Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Can we pipe aboard
the tremendous
Philip Barry.
Thank you,
and
Philip.
Duncan Edwards and Duncan Ed Newman.
There's a name, Duncan Edwards. Go on.
Yeah, Baz and Kath.
Okay.
Andy Hill, who I think is an annual patron. Peter Kelly, Jocelyn Randall, and the tremendously named Harbinaut.
Harbinaut.
All very welcome.
Well, it's very nice to have you all join the team. And, what you're helping do is to keep this ship afloat. And this ship does a variety of things, some of which you may have heard or seen, some of which you may not have done. Podcasts like this, our regular Word in Your Ear sort of evenings, events, crowdcast events with authors. We've had some already that which are out there. There'll be the next one featuring me, actually.
Cheers, I'm not going to
know. And but also our very popular Word in Your Attic series, which goes from strength to strength. And if you look on the on patreon.com/wordinyourear, you'll find the full details of how you could avail yourself of the opportunity of having a Mark Ellen and myself, magically, by the magic of digital media, appear in your attic and look
in
at
your home.
Junk on the occasion of your birthday. And so there's all this stuff going on.
Your chance to show us all your rare and coveted albums.
So basically, if you want to make sure you don't miss any of this stuff, and you want to make sure that you get it first, and you want to make sure that you see things as well as hear things, you've got to have a look at what we're offering for our Patreon supporters. So as I said, patreon.com/wordinyourear. Roll up. The more the merrier. Okay. And we'll see you next week.
Next time.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.